Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, brought to you from Santa Clara University. My name is Paul Locatelli, president of Santa Clara University and your chair for this evening. I want to thank both the Commonwealth Club and Santa Clara University Center for Science, Technology, and Society for co-sponsoring this evening's program. It's my pleasure to introduce the guest speaker tonight, Ned Barnholtz. Since May 1999, Ned has served as the president and CEO of Agilent Technologies, one of the world's leading diversified technology companies specializing in communication, electronics, healthcare, and life sciences. Part of Hewlett-Packard's company's corporate realignment, Agilent Technologies has grown into a multi-billion dollar company with offices worldwide. At Agilent, Ned works to build products to solve everyday problems that affect all of us and provide world-class service with uncompromising integrity and excellence. What is equally refreshing is that Ned's vision for the future includes major growth for his company, combined with a firm commitment to corporate citizenship. Dedicated towards helping communities, Agilent's after-school program provides hands-on science education targeted towards pre-high school age students, and they also fund the world's first and only fully equipped airborne surgical flying hospital. Before joining Agilent, Ned served as Executive Vice President and General Manager of Hewlett-Packard's Measurement Organization Department. He also serves as Director of KLA Tencor Corporation and the Tech Museum of Innovation. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Barnholtz.
Thank you, Paul, for that very nice introduction, and thanks to all of you for coming out this evening, and welcome to all the students, Commonwealth Club members, and friends. It's a real honor for me to speak here tonight at the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. It's a tremendous organization. I applaud you for your work. Since 1903, the Commonwealth Club has been dedicated to sharing information, encouraging knowledge, and keeping all of us up to date on current affairs. The purpose of this organization has probably never been more important than today, with all the fast-moving changes in the world we live in technology and our political and economic environment. So tonight, I'd like to share some thoughts with you about the world of technology and some of the technologies that I think are bringing very profound changes to the way that we live and work. These are in the areas of communications and life sciences. And each of these areas, we're seeing new knowledge every day, and this knowledge is impacting our lives in ways that we can only begin to predict. So it's a very exciting time that we live in. So my comments tonight will really be looking at the big picture about the markets and industries we're in. I'll make a few comments about our company as I go along. But I hope my remarks will add some new insights and understanding about some of these revolutions that we're part of and also elicit some questions for our discussion later. Now, we at Agilent are very deeply involved in both of the revolutions in communications and life sciences. We play an enabling role in being at the leading edge of technologies in each of these markets. One of our vice presidents tells a story that demonstrates how communications capabilities are converging. A year ago, he went to China to adopt a new baby girl with his wife, their first child. He wanted to share this experience with his friends and family back home here in the United States. So he brought a digital camera along and read the manual on his plane ride to China. When his wife held their new daughter in her arms for the first time, he snapped the picture, went back to the hotel, and within minutes, that picture was on the web so all his friends and family could see their new baby. They shared this special moment within minutes of of this time in their life. In the area of life sciences, also, humanity has passed an incredible milestone. This year, we learned the secret instructions for creating our cells. Each of us is a 10 trillion celled organism, and now that we know the sequence of nearly 3 billion units of DNA, These units, all in nature's four-letter programming code, specify the genetic makeup of each and every one of us. Although cracking the code is really a remarkable scientific achievement, it's really just the beginning. Researchers are only now building on that accomplishment to discover the role that genes play in diseases and devise more accurate diagnostics to treat diseases more efficiently. If you look at the person sitting next to you, 99.9% of your genes perfectly match the other person's, but the remaining 0.1% of your genes vary, and it's these variations that most interest drug companies. So you can't open a newspaper or a magazine today without some reference to these revolutions in communications, how all the different forms of information are converging, voice, data, video, so that we can use and access information anytime, any place, in any format. And you also find articles on medicine and life sciences, how modern genetics promise new therapies and new cures. We at Agilent are very excited about these possibilities. We've participated for a long time in work that's led up to these current revolutions in communications and life sciences. In fact, for almost 60 years of our history, when we were first part of Hewlett-Packard Company and since November 1 last year as an independent company. We introduced our first communications product in 1939, an audio oscillator, which is an electronic instrument used to test sound equipment. Walt Disney ordered 8 oscillators for the production of the movie Fantasia. That was the beginning of the Hewlett-Packard Company. We entered the life sciences arena in 1961 when we purchased a medical company called Sanborn in Waltham, Massachusetts. And that's when we began building electronic products to help with the diagnostics of heart diseases. Our goal in communications and life sciences is to revolutionize the way people live and work through technologies. During our early years in communications and life sciences, not many people knew about our products, mostly engineers and doctors. But looking back, we see that our early experiences in both of these areas positioned us well for the current advances in both fields. So tonight I'll give you an overview of both areas and share some perspectives on what we see ahead. Let me first talk about communications. Even with all of Agilent's background in communications, I still find it hard to believe that it's only been 7 years since the internet began to move into our homes, dorm rooms, and offices. Who would have imagined that a network designed in the 60s to let computers speak with one another, wherever they were in the world, could change the way we communicate? Since 1994, the population of internet users has grown from about 13 million users to more than 300 million users around the world. About half of these users are in North America, and most of the users still reach the internet by the way of the public telephone network. We're now dependent on the web for email, for our businesses, for buddy chats, shopping, procurement, research, and none of us at Agilent would go back to the paperwork to send a purchase order. Getting connected is easier than ever before, thanks to cheaper service, low-cost computers, and the efforts of governments, philanthropy organizations, and employers to make access ubiquitous. In Lapland, one of Europe's most northernmost villages, a reindeer herder, John Henrik Ira, uses the web to keep up with the latest reindeer news. He says the traditional media never carry any stories on reindeer. And in Britain, Richard Consell used the web to help his family farm recover after the effects of the mad cow disease that hit Britain's beef industry in 1998. He turned the farm into an organic operation. Because organic products are more expensive than conventional ones, he set up a cooperative with 9 other organic farmers in 1999 and took their goods online. Selling direct lowered their costs substantially. All of the farms are now profitable. Council says the internet has been the salvation of these small family farms. Going forward, predictions are that wireless web will be central to our future. Now, whenever I use the word future, I need to use the word to use a disclaimer. I'm very aware that looking into the future is very dangerous. For example, you can guess the response that a management professor at Yale had to his student's paper proposing reliable overnight delivery service. He said, "The concept is interesting and well-formed, but in order to get better than a C, the idea must be feasible." The student was Fred Smith, who went on to found Federal Express. 1954, the manager of the Grand Ole Opry, Jim Jenny, fired a new singer after one performance. "You ain't going nowhere, son. You ought to go back to driving a truck." The guy he fired, Elvis Presley. So predictions of the future are very dangerous. But the basic concept of the wireless web is simple. Allow people to access the internet from cellular phones, handheld computers, and other portable gadgets. The wireless web is building on the popularity of our cell phones. For example, mobile phone companies in the United States have signed up more than 100 million subscribers, a milestone reached in less than two decades. About 36% U.S. residents have mobile phones 17 years after the first unit hit the market. And wireless companies are adding a new subscriber every 1.3 seconds. By contrast, traditional phone service took 91 years to get to 100 million customers, and the television needed 54 years to reach 100 million homes. So what will the wireless web do for us? Well, when you walk to a bus stop, you'll use your digital companion to find out if the buses are running on time. On your bus, your device will beep an alert if you've been outbid for a painting on an eBay online auction. You'll be able to send a higher bid. The kid on the same bus will play an interactive game with a friend on the internet or listen to music that was downloaded earlier to his wireless device. A man in a taxi passing by will use his device to check the opening prices on his stocks. Access to the wireless internet, access to the wireless internet is spreading fast. The number of American households getting internet access from wireless devices, cell phones, pagers, personal digital assistants, rose to 7.4 million last July, up 12% from May, and 20% of all the households with these devices don't even have a PC. Phones and pagers with internet access are far more popular in Europe and Japan, mainly because going online through PCs is much more expensive there. Games and short messaging services are among the most popular applications. If you're in Finland, where 71% of the people use cell phones, you can send text messages to your friends, pay your bills, get traffic reports, and buy a cup of coffee simply by dialing the right numbers. Analysts predict that wireless devices will show tremendous growth. The use of non-PC devices with internet access will grow about 50% per year, and that the number of Western Europeans using wireless internet access will reach 6.6 million by the end of 2000, and more than triple to somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 million. 21 million by 2005. The evolution to third-generation wireless networks will drive this growth. The first generation of cellular phones starting in 1980s were analog devices that transmitted radio waves modulated to match the sound waves of user voices. Today's digital cell phones that came out in the early 90s are second generation. They convert sound information to bits of data carried modulated by modulated radio or microwaves. Currently, however, users of cell phones and other handheld devices are frustrated by the slow speed of wireless transmission, less than one-fifth of the rate of a typical PC modem over a fixed telephone line. Communication companies are now working on the third generation, called 3G, wireless networks that are expected in the next few years. These could increase the data rates of mobile devices enough to allow users to download songs and movies from the web. In order for all generations of wireless and wired connections to work, people to people, people to phones, wired wire lines, computer to computer, Companies like Agilent are working with network equipment manufacturers and service providers to build the future information infrastructure. Soon we'll expect infinite, nearly free, two-way communications links, the same way we depend on electrical connections today. Internet traffic is doubling every 3 months, and it turns out that optical technology is the only practical way to carry all of this information. Optical equipment has helped drive down the price of moving information over long distances to 0.0006% of what it was in 1996. If BMW could do that, you could buy a new car for $2.50. So optics is putting Moore's Law to shame. Analysts predict that optical equipment will continue to double the capacity it delivers at any fixed price every 9 months, or twice the speed of improvements in the semiconductor performance set out by Gordon Moore of Intel. So more low-cost bandwidth will mean we'll search for information faster, we'll communicate faster, whether by voice, data, sound, or video, or some combination of all of these. And in fact, last year I had the opportunity to attend the every four-year Telecom 99 show in Geneva. And there's a real blurring of what's a telephone, what's a PC, what's a personal digital assistant. I think it's going to be very, very difficult to tell. So now let's switch gear to the life sciences area. Imagine going to a doctor's office for an appointment. Once your doctor makes the diagnosis about your problem, you can hand him or her what looks like a credit card. This card is put into a machine, and in a few seconds, your entire genetic structure is revealed. The doctor reads it and identifies any possible genetic cause of your problem. If you have a miscoded genetic sequence that can lead to a disease, the doctor may be able to insert a more functional gene or have your genes repaired. But we're a long way, perhaps 50 years from the time of such a procedure is common. But even though in the last decade the genes for some of the major diseases have been identified, Alzheimer's, muscular dystrophy, diabetes, the work ahead is very complicated. While we think of DNA as libraries of our cells and the codes for the proteins our bodies make, it's the proteins that act as little chemists in our cells to carry out the chemical reactions. Think about how different a caterpillar is from a butterfly. Each has exactly the same gene sequence. What differs are the proteins. And it's the proteins that drugs act on. You have about 1,000 billion proteins acting in your body right now. So you can see it's a very complex research project to find out how genes give instructions to proteins, and then what drugs would have a therapeutic impact on a particular protein. When you need a prescription today for anything, your doctor has about 2,000 drugs available that are effective for about 500 protein targets associated with disease. By 2006, we estimate that about 2,000 to 10,000 protein targets will be identified from the Human Genome Project and other ongoing work. This new ability to identify specific genes related to disease means that researchers and pharmaceutical companies will be able to develop tests and perhaps target drugs specifically for those disorders. So what's coming in life sciences? Now, what's called a lab on a chip can analyze compounds in something the size of a commemorative postage stamp. In the near future, when your doctor orders a blood test, you won't go to a clinic to have a nurse draw 3 to 4 tubes of blood. The lab on a chip will analyze a blood sample so small you'll barely be able to see it, and you won't even feel the tiny puncture. Future advances will be smaller still. For someone diagnosed with cancer, doctors will be able to deliver drugs directly to individual cancer cells without affecting the rest of your body. Tiny capsules of drugs will circulate through your body like microscopic submarines hunting for cancer cells. When the medication capsules attached to cancer cells, ultrasound technology can provide energy to break the capsules on the surface of the cancer cells, thus delivering the drug cell by cell and reducing the unpleasant side effects of traditional chemotherapy. We'll inject genetic compounds such as short DNA sequences that program blood vessels to grow where you want them. In the future, if you suffer from heart disease, you may not have to endure a heart bypass operation. Instead, your doctor will implant something like a tiny chemical factory on the surface of your heart that causes new blood vessels to grow in the area of low circulation. Researchers have already succeeded in growing blood vessels experimentally, and good-sized ones too, a millimeter across or more. The vision for advancement in drug discovery is a new approach, that molecular information will become the basis for day-to-day decisions in healthcare. So diagnostics and therapy won't be based only on generalized medical practices and traditional clinical chemistry, but also on your own individual biochemistry. This will lead to earlier diagnosis and faster recovery. Agilent scientists are working with scientists in the National Human Genome Research Institute, part of the National Institute of Health, to study cancer. Until recently, scientists have been able to analyze only a few genes at once. However, with the development of DNA microarray technology, an area where Agilent is involved, scientists can now examine thousands of genes at the same time. This process makes it easier and faster to determine the complex relationships among individual genes. With the increased use of technologies to analyze genes and proteins, pharmaceutical companies will be able to develop many more drugs much faster than we've ever seen before. That's because they're starting to find the disease mechanisms in our bodies, those targets that respond to drug treatment in a way that wasn't possible before. Because almost every disease has a genetic component, genetic diagnostics will enable doctors to begin treatment earlier, perhaps even before the symptoms are visible. So what about lifestyle choices like exercise, diet, rest? If almost every disease has a genetic component, do we just say, my genes did it? Well, no way. A recent study suggests that the environment, what we eat, drink, breathe, and smoke, how we live, accounts for roughly twice the risk of cancer that genes do. Although communications and life sciences may look independent today, in fact, they're very complementary. Each contributes to progress in the other. For example, communications enables advancements in genetics and diagnostics in life sciences. As healthcare moves from the hospital to outpatient and home care, medicine will become more personalized with wireless devices and in-home diagnostics. And life sciences, such as the knowledge of interactions of atoms and molecules, enable advances in future communications capabilities, such as nanotechnology, molecular switching, and even DNA computing. For example, at Agilent, our expertise in test and measurement enable us to leap a gap to compete in the next technology wave communications. And our work in life sciences enabled us to use our communications expertise to further advances in genetics. So both of these fields, communications and life sciences, may be converging over the long term. Perhaps we'll see bioelectronic and quantum systems where we'll be able to build molecular electronic circuits with DNA. Work is already going on in this area in a number of advanced research labs, including ours at Agilent. But even though we can describe these technology waves, it's very difficult to predict what's coming. We know that some trends will continue, like the trend for technology to make products cheaper, smaller, faster. But we'll also encounter some surprises along the way, like the internet. So how do we move forward? How do all of us plan for the future? P- Peter Drucker said, strategic planning is necessary because we cannot forecast. Strategic planning does not deal with future decisions. It deals with the futurity of present decisions. Decisions exist only in the present. The question that faces the strategic decision maker, and I would say all of us who make important decisions, the question is not what our organization should do tomorrow. The question is, what do we have to do today to get ready for an uncertain future? Our goal at Agilent is to revolutionize the way people live and work through technology, with significant and worthwhile contributions for you, our families, our friends, all the people worldwide, and future generations. It's my hope for each of us that you can decide how best to prepare yourself for what I hope is a very rewarding, surprising, and exciting future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ned, for your thoughtful reflections on the future of communications and life sciences. Now I would like to introduce Peter Giles, who will conduct our question and answer period. Peter has been president and CEO of the Tech Museum of Innovation since 1987. Previous to that, he was president of the Santa Clara County Manufacturing Group. Peter serves as a member of the Commonwealth Club Valley Advisory Board. Peter.
Thank you. Thank you. Here we have some questions for you, Mr. Barnholt, and would like to begin with one that states that Emin Fingleton has argued that America is sacrificing its long-term economic well-being to the short-term new economy. To support this contention, he points out that the U.S. imports more manufactured goods than it imports. That it imports, I think, more than it exports, yes. Can you comment on this contention? Are we really slipping behind in sacrificing our long-term goods to the new economy?
Well, I'm an optimist when it comes to our economy. I believe that, the economies always go through different evolutions, and we've moved from one level of competition to another. I think the days when we would compete on the basis of our sheer manufacturing capability are probably behind us for many businesses. Now, there are still some businesses where manufacturing is a strategic advantage and value added. But for many businesses, the value added in putting a personal computer together or some of the other types of consumer products that we see out there are really diminished. So it's really incumbent on the companies that are involved in those businesses to compete in those markets the best way they can. And I think what's happening is the competition is moving to a new plane. It's moving to knowledge competition. It's moving to innovation and contributions. And I think what we see in the United States economy is a very, very vibrant, robust economy. If you look at the innovations, even in the personal computer business, even though a lot of the manufacturing is done offshore or done in outsourced companies, the innovations from the businesses are coming from companies like Dell and Compaq and even Hewlett-Packard and others that are really innovating in the business model and how products are delivered to customers. I think if you look at some of the businesses that I talked about in communications and life sciences, these are at a different phase. Today there are more there is more value added in manufacturing, although even some of that is being done offshore or in outsourced companies. But the competition is around innovation and knowledge and advancing the technology. And if you look at the economy of the United States, who's the leader in the computer business? Who's the leader in the communications business? Who's driving the trends in the life science business? In those areas, The U.S. companies, I think, are really the who's who in most of these really hot markets that we see around the world. So I think when we talk about competition, we need to not look at it the way it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. We need to look at the way it is today. And are American companies doing well in the world economies and the new economies, setting the pace, innovating, becoming market leaders? Absolutely, yes.
What are the challenges faced by service providers building the future internet infrastructure in finance and demand uncertainty, and how do they affect Agilent?
Well, that's a very good question. I think clearly with the rise and the fall of some of the dot-com companies, it's clearly a very, very dynamic situation. There was a lot of money thrown after the new economy, a lot of the internet companies, a lot of the service providers that were out there trying to create new opportunities. I think there will probably be some convergence and some shakeout in these businesses, because the financial model about how some of these companies are going to make money is still unclear. But I believe that there will be an internet service provider, application service provider set of companies that emerge to lead the new economy and that will find a business model that will work. But that probably means that all of the companies out there today probably won't survive, because I don't think there's enough business for all of them to make it.
This is a question about your role at Agilent. It says, as CEO of such a large company, 42,000 employees, how much responsibility do you take in molding corporate culture?
Good question. Actually, it's 46,000 employees, but we added about 4,000 this year. I believe that's probably one of my main roles. If you look at the role of a CEO at any company, I think it really boils down to about three major priorities. Number one is building the vision and setting the direction for the organization. Somebody's got to do that. Somebody's got to make the calls, and that's generally the CEO. Second of all is you've got to build the team. Nobody's going to be successful by themselves. You've got to surround yourself with great people. You've got to build a great organization, or nothing's going to work. And then third is building the culture and creating the environment where you can really empower your people and bring out the best in your people. So I personally spend a lot of time on culture and developing the leadership skills throughout our entire organization. For example, this year, We've taken advantage of the fact that we're a new company. I've referred to us as an $8 billion startup. That's what we were last year. We'll be a little over $10 billion this year. But it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to build on our rich heritage, which we're all very proud of in HP, but also change in ways that can make us even more successful going forward. So we've put all of our top 6,000 managers and supervisors through a new leadership development program this year. I've personally spent 2 days with every one of our top 200 managers and leaders talking about the new leadership model and the new culture that we want to have in our company that's built on our heritage but different in ways that we think can make us even more successful. So I view it as one of my top priorities, and I think it should be a top priority for any CEO.
I understand the A in your logo has a story behind it. Can you share the story?
Well, that was an interesting turn of events. When we named our company, by the way, one of the most difficult things for any of you thinking about starting a company, probably the hardest decision you'll have to make is your name. Virtually every name that you can think of is in the dictionary is taken. And when you think about a company like Agilent that does business in 120 countries around the world, Just about any name is conflicted somewhere that you can think of. So you have to go into think about coin names, which is what Agilent is. And the reason that we liked Agilent was we felt it was a good reminder to us and our customers every day about our need to be fast, to be agile, to be responsive to their needs. And it's really interesting talking about creating a culture in the company. We're always talking about whether we are being agile-lent or not. So we're creating a new word. But in terms of the A, once we set the name of our company, then we had to decide what was our symbol going to be on the New York Stock Exchange, and we discovered that all the symbols that made any sense at all, built from Agilent, were already taken. So I started talking to Dick Grasso, the head of the New York Stock Exchange, and noticed that A was untaken, and we said we would really like A, and he says, oh no, you can't have A, it was already reserved for some other companies. And so we worked on them for a long time, and finally I said, look, the New York Stock Exchange wants to be a high-tech exchange. They're always worried that they're in the shadow of NASDAQ and the high-tech market. I said, what better way for you to be a high-tech exchange than have the first company listed to be a high-tech company? He says, you're right, you can have A. So we're very happy with it.
I understand that Agilent has two divergent focuses. How do they come together, or do they take parallel paths? I don't see a connection or common ground.
Well, that's also a good question. Investors ask me that a lot. I think if you look at Agilent, we clearly are in different businesses. But underneath the surface, even though the businesses may look different in their customer base, there's a lot of commonalities. First of all, they are all high-tech businesses. They require a lot of investment in research and development. We have to be on the leading edge of technology in each of the business areas that we're in. So the business models about how we do business is very similar across these businesses. And I always remind people that it's very interesting. Hewlett-Packard started as an electronic measurement company in 1939. And the first acquisition that Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard made was a medical device company in Waltham, Massachusetts, that made medical measurement products. So the view is whether you're measuring physiological parameters like the heart, or later we made an acquisition of a chemical measurement company, whether you're measuring chemical products, or whether you're measuring electronic products, they're all fundamentally measurement. And we can exchange technologies, we can reuse a lot of even software, we can reuse a lot of knowledge about how to do business, even though the end businesses are very similar, are very different. So within a company like Agilent, the only way we can manage this is to structure the organization to have different organizations focused on different businesses. I have a team of people that are focused on the life science business. They wake up every day thinking about customers, market opportunities, what's going on in those businesses. I have a team of people focused on the semiconductor products business. We have a team focused on communications. And it's that decentralization of decision-making and empowerment of our people that I think is really at the core of the success. Now, at the end of the day, though, there's got to be 1 + 1 = 3, or investors say, well, I can do that better than you can. And I do think that the synergies come from the sharing of know-how, the sharing of technology, and really sharing of a lot of the common infrastructure. I'll just tell one more story. One of the things that a diversified company like ours allows you to do is bring multiple technologies together to solve new problems. It's very interesting that the new DNA arrays that we introduced about a year ago were built on HP's inkjet printer technology. The new photonic switch that we just developed and introduced earlier this year is also based on the inkjet printer technology. So having world-class chemists and world-class mechanical, electrical engineers, biologists, all in one advanced research labs really leads to breakthrough ideas that I think would be very difficult to come up with if you're in a pure play vertical company.
The digital revolution required exponential increases in capacity and decreases in cost. What technology breakthroughs will be required to enable biochip technology to become affordable to the entire life sciences research community?
Well, we are still in the very early phases of this, and probably just like it was difficult for people to predict, you know, what would drive a semiconductor device to a few cents a chip. I think today it's probably difficult to predict what's going to drive a DNA chip to somewhere in that same price range. But all I can say is that, as we're moving forward, we're putting in place some mass production capability. We are using a lot of knowledge and expertise from some of our other businesses to put in place a manufacturing capability, which we believe really allows very, very low-cost chip manufacturing. So I think it's going to take some time, however, for the cost to get to the point where it's going to be in all of our homes. We see today the application of DNA DNA arrays and a lot of the genomic tools that I talked about really being applied first in drug research labs, academic institutions, places that actually do have some money for research and development. But at the same time, there's a lot of people, ourselves included, as well as a lot of venture capital money going into thinking about how do you make this same technology very, very low cost. So I think the application of DNA technology to diagnostics and therapies in the healthcare industry is a little bit behind some of the initial work. But I'm convinced over the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see some significant breakthroughs, and we're working on them in Agilent Labs, and unfortunately, I can't tell you about them right now.
How do you see the prospects? This is a three-part question. How do you see the prospects for cost reduction in accessing the wireless internet? Will they be as dramatic as in office networking? What will Agilent offer?
Well, in terms of wireless capability, I think we're just coming into an inflection point. If you look at wireless technology today, it's basically a voice technology. There's very little data being transmitted over a wireless network. Today, if you look at the wireline networks, the data content is about 7 to 10 times the voice content. So over the next 5 years, you're going to see that same shift in the wireless network. You're going to see a predominance of data out there in the next 3 to 5 years, and that will drive down a lot of the cost. The new services will drive new applications, which will require new devices, which will bring, I think, much lower cost solutions. So I think we're just at the beginning of the curve. And as I look at what a number of companies are doing that are in the wireless marketplace, it's really interesting to see that the first generation and second generation phones that a lot of us use today really haven't been designed as much from the point of view of a consumer. But if you look at what's coming in the future in some of the next generation phones, you're going to see much more of a consumer-oriented approach to those products, again, which will continue to be to take advantage of the low-cost manufacturing techniques, which will drive the price down. So I think there's a kind of a symbiotic relationship. New services are going to drive new demands, which will create lower-cost platforms, which will be more consumer-like. And over the next 5 years, I think you'll see a tremendous reduction in the cost of wireless services as well as the devices themselves.
What, another Agilent question, what do you feel is the most important product or research that Agilent has produced?
Well, that's kind of a tough one because, You know, I think there's been so many over the years that have really made a difference, and I won't dwell on the past because I would probably come up with too long a list. But if I just focus on the present, I think there are two major innovations that we came up with just in the last 9 months that we're very, very excited about. One is this DNA array technology that I talked about. Very revolutionary, really changing the way new diseases, new drugs are being discovered, the way drug companies are doing research. It's very exciting, and it's getting a very excellent response. The second area is the photonic switch I mentioned. Many people say that the last remaining missing element in the all optical network is the switch itself. Today, if you're building an all optical network to do the switching, you generally have to go from your optical signal to electrical signals where you do all the switching and then back to optical. It's very complex, very costly. So the photonic switch that we developed is a way of switching light itself, which significantly lowers the cost, improves the reliability of the all-optical network. But I think these are two examples, as I mentioned earlier, about how some of our advanced research brings together multiple technologies and really makes some breakthroughs in areas that, frankly, are very difficult to conceive of in one of our business units. Our business units are focused on getting new products out every day. They're focused on evolutionary moves in technology. But our advanced research labs, where we spend about 10% of our billion-dollar R&D investment in advanced research, their job is to look over the horizon 3 to 5 years out at new technologies that can either impact our current businesses or help us get into new businesses. And, part of their job is to help us look for new opportunities for our company going forward. And these two that I just mentioned are just examples in the last 9 months of doing that.
We have more and more technology designed to connect us to each other, and yet we are more and more isolated. What do you think community will look like in the future? What is to stop us from becoming a version of Isaac Asimov's Solaria, a planet where people lived in complete isolation?
Well, if you turn your cell phone off, I suppose it's complete isolation, but anymore, I feel more connected than I've ever been before. You know, I think the nice thing about the technologies that are being developed is they create choice. I think if you look at the technologies that I talked about, the wireless technology, digital photography, the internet, allowing people to connect with one another anywhere, any place, any time, like the story of our engineer getting his new baby in China, I think that's a great example of where our connected world is really working for the benefit of all of us. And there are countless stories like that I think where you can really see the benefits of connectedness. On the flip side, you can carry, like anything, these technologies to extreme. I think you can let technology be the master instead of you being the master. And I think it's important to put technology in a place. It's a tool. It's a tool to help us in the way we conduct our lives. Like any tool, it can be misused. But I think that's a personal choice. But I think it's important for all of us, and there's a whole another discussion around, the ethics and all of the practices around technology, some of the new ways that we have to change the way we live because of technologies is a whole field of science in and of itself that probably deserves another discussion. But I think, personally, the benefits outweigh the risk, but clearly we're going to have to manage those choices ourselves as we go forward.
You mentioned that a recent study indicates that the environment, what we eat, drink, breathe, and smoke, accounts for twice the risk of cancer that genes do. What are the R&D departments doing to clean up our environment and control their toxic emissions?
Well, we actually have a business that helps with that, too. Our chemical analysis is a business that we've been in for a number of years, works to analyze the gases, the liquids that are emanated from factories, that looks at our water, that looks at our air and the kinds of contaminants that are in our air. And here again, I think science and technology can play a very important role. There are technologies today to reduce the cost of many of these detection devices where you can put them in rooms, you can put them in factories, you can see on a real-time basis what's happening in your environment. And I think we all need to be looking at how we can use these technologies for the benefit. But clearly this is another topic that probably deserves a broader discussion, but I think the environmental impact of all of these different technologies we need to manage like any society. There's risks, there's downsides. If we don't manage it well, it can be abused. There's a lot of work going on today in reusability, design for the life of a product, including the disposal of products. There's laws now about how PCs are disposed. All of these things are going to have to be considered when you design products if we're going to continue as an industry, as a high-tech industry, to try to be out in front of all of these different environmental issues in our labs. It really needs to pay attention. Design for minimum power, design for disposability, design for reuse. All of these design fors are now an important part of the criteria of the research programs in every one of our labs, and I would imagine most of our customers and competitors as well.
What caused the tremendous drop of your stocks last year? And why do they not recover?
Well, that's an interesting question, too. Somebody asked me about how do I feel with our stock dropping from 165 down to wherever it was at the time, 50 or so. I said, well, I never thought it should be 165 in the first place. That was your decision, not mine. I think we've been in a real crazy market, this last year. I think if you could spell fiber optics, your multiple was probably about four or five times what it normally would be, and that certainly was the case for us when we first introduced our photonic switch last March. Our stock price went up 60 points in one day. I think that's unprecedented in the history of Hewlett-Packard Company to have the stock go up 60 points in one day due to one product introduction. To tell you, though, about the state of the market, what we introduced was a technology. The next day I was at a Morgan Stanley investment conference, and somebody asked me, by the way, when are you going to start shipping that product? And I said, well, not for a year. This is a product that has to be designed into our customer's product. And they say, really, not for a year? So our stock went right back down to 100. You would think that somebody would ask that question before they bought the stock. So, this has been a really wild year from the market point of view. And somebody had also asked me, how am I going to manage the company differently now that the stock is down versus where it was? And I said, look, we're going to look for ways we can grow our company 20% per year and deliver 8 or 9% net profit. If I do that year in and year out, over the 60-year history or whatever of the company, you can decide whatever multiple you want to put on that. I can't make that choice. But I think if we can deliver on our commitments, which is to grow the company and to make good profit for our shareholders over the long term, shareholders will be rewarded. But the market will definitely go through some gyrations like it did this year.
I keep hearing that phones that will also show a live picture of the person calling or coming. Who on earth thinks this is a good idea? Not only for security reasons, I'll have to try to look decent just to place a 2-minute phone call.
Well, I have bad news for you. I think a lot of the next generation phones are including digital cameras. In fact, many of those chips are coming from our semiconductor products business. But I think here again, it's a choice. You can decide whether you want to turn it on or not. It's a choice whether you want to buy that option or not. So you do have some choices. The advantages, though, are if you look at some of these futuristic phones. So let's suppose you go to New York City and you're trying to decide what restaurant you want to go to. You go to your phone, which looks different than today's phone. It has a set of icons on it. You click on it that says restaurants. It pulls up a menu or a list of restaurants that you can choose from, whether you want Chinese or American or fish or whatever. You pick which one, which category you want. You have a series of restaurants. You go in, pick the restaurant you want to look at. You can check their menu, and then you can call them up, and you can actually have a camera that will show you the inside of the restaurant. You can decide whether you want to go there or not. You can see what the waiting line is. Again, there's a lot of services that can become available over the net. If you want to, before you go out on the freeway tonight, if you want to go see what the traffic's like, you can take your phone, you can dial up a website, go check the cam recorder out there on the freeway and see whether there's a better traffic on 101 or 280. Those are the kind of applications that you'll have at your palm top, you know, with the next generation phones. Now, you can decide whether you want to look at your neighbor or call your friends or decide whether you want to look at each other or not. But, again, that may be something that you choose to do if you want to look at the grandkids and see how your sons or daughters are doing in college. At least that's a option that you would have at your disposal.
That concludes our question and answers. We would like again to thank Ned Barnholtz, President and CEO of Agilent Technology, and Peter Giles, President and CEO of the Tech Museum of Innovation. Thanks also to the Commonwealth Club and Santa Clara University's Center for Science, Technology, and Society for co-sponsoring this evening's program, and to all of you for joining us. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, a part of the nation's largest and oldest public affairs forum, is adjourned.